William L. Myers Jr. is a Philadelphia lawyer and now a best-selling author, out with his third book, A Killer's Alibi.
When I first met you, you had just written your first book. And now...
I just submitted the fourth book to my agent, and she's reviewing it. The third book, which is A Killer's Alibi, just came out.
And tell me a little bit about what it's about.
Well, A Killer's Alibi, I'm really excited about this book because it has two major plots. One involves Jimmy Nunzio, who's a Philadelphia crime lord, who is caught in a warehouse with a bloody knife in his hand over the body of his arch rival, who also happens to be his daughter's lover. The other plot involves a young woman who was convicted 15 years ago of murdering her sexually abusive father, and she's been in jail. And so one of the protagonists, Piper McFarland, whose husband is Mick McFarland, who was the main protagonist in the first book, Piper is running the firm's own innocence project, and she believes that this young woman, Darlene Dowd, is innocent, and she's come across some evidence that the jury did not have. And so she's trying to go out and gather more evidence to show that Darlene is, in fact, innocent, to get her out of prison.
Wow.
So both of the themes involve fathers and daughters. In the Darlene Dowd theme, you have an abusive father and a daughter who was charged with killing him. In the Jimmy Nunzio plot, you have this troubled relationship between Jimmy and his 20-something daughter, Christina. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that Jimmy does not want to see Christina for who she is. And that causes a lot of friction between them.
And is this set in Philadelphia as well?
Of course it is. All my books are set in Philadelphia. I love Philadelphia. I know the justice system here. So all the trials take place over at the Criminal Justice Center, which anyone who reads these books and who's from Philadelphia will recognize from TV and the news footage. That's where all my criminal cases are tried. And so I think it speaks to Philadelphia.
These names are fictional, right?
The names are fictional. Absolutely. I'm not going to name real mobsters in my book.
And how'd you come up with this idea?
I wanted to explore the relationship between a father and a daughter. And so the first plot came to me was Jimmy Nunzio and Christina. And I wanted to create a situation where a very dangerous man who happens to be a father, who happens to have a daughter that he loves, has a daughter with whom he has a problematic relationship, and something happens between them that leads to him being charged with murder and creates all this friction and tension between them, but also adds an element to the relationship between Jimmy Nunzio and his criminal defense attorney, who's the protagonist, Mick McFarland. Normally, when you're a criminal defense lawyer representing a criminal defendant, you're running the show. You're making the decisions. You're the puppeteer. In this relationship, where Jimmy Nunzio, this crime boss, is the client, and he is a man used to calling the shots, the relationship between him and Mick is of two, think of Machiavellian manipulators, dancing around each other. And their goal is the same. Mick wants to get Jimmy Nunzio cleared of this crime, for which he's obviously guilty. Jimmy Nunzio wants the same thing, but Nunzio's not being upfront with Mick. He's hiding things, holding things back, and it's frustrating Mick. So Mick goes behind Nunzio to Nunzio's family and friends to try to get information that'll prove to be the key that unlocks this thing and gets Nunzio off.
I guess you can't tell me the ending.
I can't tell you the ending. You wouldn't want me to tell you the ending. One of the things that I do in the books is I lay the seeds for what the ending will be, but I hopefully lay them subtly enough that when the ending happens, you're surprised. You're not stunned. You don't say, oh, there's no way that could happen. You say, oh, that's right. Now I remember this. Now I remember that. So the endings are surprises, but they're fair surprises.
And so you've gone from writing one book in your spare time mm-hmm. to now you're on your fourth one.
Yes.
I mean, how do you do it?
Well, I mean, it's hard. The first thing I found, though, was I wasted a lot of time. I'm very busy as a lawyer, but even being a lawyer running a full-time practice, I found that there are still moments and hours where I'm not really doing anything productive. So I took a lot of that time, and I used that time to write the books. There's also a lot of downtime where, for example, I walk the dogs in the park every morning. And when I'm walking the dogs in the park, ideas come to me. Scenes, dialogue, whole plot turns and twists, because the mind is still working. And I'm sure you've found the same thing, and most people have. You have a problem. You can't work it out. You bang your head against the wall. It's only when you step away from it that your brain comes up with the answer. And for me, when I'm writing the books, that happens a lot too.
Wow. And so did you ever expect to wind up here? You've been a lawyer. You went to college here? Or
I went to college at a small state college near Pittsburgh. I went to law school at Penn in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and I've been in Philadelphia ever since 1980.
Did you grow up in Philadelphia?
Grew up in Lancaster.
Lancaster.
So not too far.
Yeah.
Not too far mile-wise, but, you know, a whole different planet in some ways.
Right. Why'd you stay in Philadelphia?
I loved Philadelphia. When I graduated from Penn, I worked for a big defense firm called Ballard Spahr for a while. And it was a great firm. I love the people I work with. But what I found was, because it was a big defense firm and I was a young associate, I didn't get to try a lot of cases. And I remember going to my mentor at the time, whose name was Jimmy Coleman. I said, Jimmy, I want to try more cases. And he looked at me and he said, Bill, first of all, we don't try cases a lot around here because there's too much money involved. We can't afford to try the cases. The clients cannot afford to try the cases. And if we do try a case, it's not going to be young associate Bill Myers who tries the case. It's going to be chairman of the litigation department who tries the case. So I went out and looked around at you know, smaller firms, plaintiff firms, and interviewed with a couple, got a couple offers, and I was still on the fence about whether to make this shift, because it's not just a shift from big firm to small firm. It's a shift from defense work to plaintiff's work. And for me, Lauren, the defining moment came was I was taking a deposition of a man who had asbestosis, and he was dying from the disease. And we were in his house. He was in a bed. His wife was there. And all these defense attorneys from all these asbestos companies were there. And all the defense attorneys were trying to get him to admit that he couldn't identify their company as being one of the companies who made the product he was exposed to. And this man's story came out. And he started out as a young worker in the shipyards. That's where he was originally exposed to asbestos. From there, he went on to found his own construction company with some friends of his. He built a lot of properties in Philadelphia. He built his own house. He got into flying. He built his own airplane. And I thought, this man is so impressive with what he's done with his life. He's the guy I should be representing. I should not be representing asbestos companies. I should be representing guys like him who get hurt by these bad products that these big companies are putting out.
And so at the time, you were there in representing the asbestos companies.
Yes, yes.
And that was the moment.
And that, for me, that was the moment where I decided I am literally going in the wrong direction here. And I have to make a sea change, and I have to make a 180-degree turn.
And when was that?
That was in 1990. I had been practicing for almost 7 years. So that was right about 1990.
And have you ever looked back?
Nope, not once. Not even, Lauren, not even once.
And so what happened with the asbestos guy?
He passed away. They call those depositions dying depositions. because the premise of the deposition is he's being videotaped because by the time his case goes to trial, he won't be there. And I have to say, his wife throughout this whole thing, with the all these young defense attorneys there and her husband in this bed dying, she, to me, I mean, she could have raged and ranted at us, but she kept her cool, and I thought, this is a very dignified woman.
And did it? How did it resolve?
I assume, because by the time it resolved, I was gone. I assumed that they paid his estate money. That's what normally happens. But, I mean, it didn't do him any good, and I'm sure his wife would have thrown that money back in a heartbeat to have her husband back.
Mm-hmm. So you represent any particular stories that you are allowed to share from your current practice?
I represent mostly men and women who work for the railroads who are injured on the railroads. And it's a dangerous job. The equipment is giant, as you know, trains. It's the design of most of this stuff hasn't changed in 100 years. And a lot of times when people get injured, they get injured terribly. My firm represented years ago a man who was impaled between two couplers. And he was alive and he was conscious. And everybody knew when they disconnected the couplers, he was going to die, including him. And so he told his coworkers to tell his wife that he loved his wife and his family, and then eventually they had to disconnect the couplers, and he died. And for the people who were there, who were watching it, it was heartbreaking. It was absolutely heartbreaking. I recently represented a man who was badly burned out on this area of track because the railroad decided it was going to ground a certain structure into a set of wires that were not designed for that purpose. So he's out there and he's manipulating the wires, connecting and disconnecting, and he has no clue that one of the wires that's feeding into it is live with 12,000 volts of electricity. And he got electrocuted. He did not die, thank God, but he was badly burned. And we just, we're litigating that case and for him and his family.
Is the what firm are you with now, your own?
Yeah, it's called the Myers Firm, and we're right in Center City, Philadelphia, right at 15th and Market Street. So we're right across the street from City Hall, where we try a lot of our cases, which is great. And we represent railroaders. We also represent people injured in, automobile accidents and medical malpractice and things of that nature.
And when you write your books, what are some of the, if there are any, favorite places from Philadelphia that you like to include other than the Criminal Justice Center?
Well, sometimes I'll put the restaurants in just because I like certain restaurants, and I won't mention any now, but when you read the book, you'll see, oh, I know that restaurant. I've been to that restaurant. And streets. I try to be very accurate about the streets. So if I have a character walking down the street, I'm very accurate as to the cross streets that he's going to cross, the buildings that are going to be on his left and his right. And the fourth book, which hasn't come out yet, involves a situation where the protagonist is framed for a murder and he's supposedly caught on video with those building surveillance videos, traveling from 15th and Market to Arch Street, where the Comcast Tower is. And I mention every building whose security cameras he passes because that becomes a part of the case. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's walked down Market Street, JFK, they know exactly what I'm talking about.
That's fun.
It is fun. I mean, it's fun to be able to incorporate Philadelphia, into the very framework of the book.
And so when you were, tell me about the process from, you've sold how many copies now of your books?
Over 500,000. That's the last I've counted, so.
And it's for sale on Amazon.
Yes. The current book is called A Killer's Alibi, and that's for sale. You can go on Amazon, A Killer's Alibi. You can get it in paperback, audiobook, Kindle. And the first book came out, I guess, geez, I want to say January, March of 17. The second book came out in 18. This is the third book, and it came out in 19. The first book was the number 6 bestseller for the year that it came out, which they told me they've never had that before for a first-time author, which made me very happy.
Wait, on Amazon, you were the 6th?
I was the 6th best-selling book in 2017.
So do you think you'll ever retire from law, write, and just travel the tropical islands or something?
I mean. No. You and I briefly talked about that, and the answer is no, because I need both things. I need to practice law, and I need to write. They're very different things, Lauren. Writing is pure right brain stuff. It's creative. It's artistic. It's a completely different feeling from legal writing and the practice of law, which is left brain, cold, hard, logic. The facts are the facts. You got to do what you can do with them. Plus, with writing, it's solitary. You know, it's isolating. And I don't know how people who all they do is write novels do it, because you're sitting somewhere by yourself and you're inside your own head. I need the social aspect of it, and, you know, running my own law firm and interacting with the clients, the staff, the opposing counsel gets me out into the real world. I also think, for me, Lauren, if I wasn't out doing that, if I wasn't out in the real world, I think I would go dry when it came to trying to find ideas for the fiction. I think, like, it feeds off of each other.
Like, you walk down the street in Philadelphia, and what kind of triggers your interest?
It could be a certain building. Like, oh, look at these two new Comcast towers. Look at the wealth and the power that they represent. I'm going to put some of my bad guys into these buildings. Some of my bad guys who also represent wealth and power. And there was a gym up in North Philly that I read about, and I don't know if it recently closed, but it had been open forever, and they did a lot of stuff for neighborhood use, where they would teach them how to box. And I thought, that's a great building, a great place for what it stands for. It stands for neighborhoods. It stands for the little guy. So in the same book that I put my bad guy, or one of my bad guys, in the Comcast Tower, right, I put my good guy in the gym, boxing, and being from that neighborhood.
And did the Comcast people get upset?
No, because I didn't make him a Comcast employee. I made him an employee of a law firm renting space in the Comcast building.
Got it. What else would you like to tell me that I didn't think to ask?
You and I talked about the whole creative process in writing a book. And a lot of times authors are asked, do you outline everything? Do you plan it all out, plot it all out, or do you just kind of go with the flow? And I think I read somewhere that Stephen King he comes up with an idea and he lets the story unfold. And I've read other authors who say, I got to know how it ends, and I got to know what all the major plot points are in order to guide my story there. And I'm kind of a mix. I know where the story is going to end. I know, say, 3 or 4 of the major plot points. I know some stuff about my characters. But when I start writing and I put the characters into the scenes and I see how the story unfolds, I learn a lot. I learn a lot about the characters. Sometimes I'm writing and characters turn out to be different people than I thought they were going to be. Sometimes a character who I thought was just going to be there for, you know, a few scenes, just so main characters would have someone to bounce ideas off of, just mushrooms into their own powerful self. And that happened in the first book, A Criminal Defense. The Marcy Hansen, the wife of David Hansen, who was charged with the murder in that case. She was just going to be a two-dimensional, oh, the defendant's wife. But Marcy Hansen turned out to be a very powerful woman in her own right. And that actually carries through in the fourth book, which I'm writing now. And Piper, who's Mick McFarlane's wife, who was originally just going to be the wife of the protagonist in the first book, she mushroomed into a full-fledged human being by the end of the first book. In A Killer's Alibi, she's not only a full-fledged human being, she's one of the people who's actually driving the story. And what I find with me is a lot of times it's the women who I start out to just put them in as the wife of this or the wife of that. And it's like, no, honey, I'm not just the wife. I'm going to drive this book. I'm going to drive this scene. I'm going to make things happen. That's what I find.
So as you're writing the book, she kind of goes off in your head and she's developing in your head. Is that it?
Exactly. She's saying things that I didn't plan for her to say. She's doing things I didn't plan for her to do. And I slowly come to realize she has her own agenda here. She has her own plans. And she has her own backstory. She has a history. And that becomes part of the fun for me. Once I see the kind of person this character is, now I've got to go back and create a backstory. I got to figure out how did she become this very strong, but at the same time, very manipulative person? How did that happen to her? And so a whole part of the story that I never thought of, never planned, comes into fruition.
And what happens now? It's at your agents.
The fourth book is at the agents.
And what happens then?
Well, the process is my agent will look at it and she'll say, okay, Bill, here's where I think you need to tighten it up. And I'll follow her lead. At the same time, I have it out to a group of people I call my first readers who are friends. And they've looked at each of the books and pointed things out, like, Bill, this character wouldn't do this, or that character wouldn't do that, or this doesn't make sense. And again, it helps me tighten up the book. And so I make all the changes. Then we submit it to the publisher. And then it goes through layer after layer after layer of professional editing.
And then?
And then it's out there in the world. Then my baby is given birth, and it's out there in the world for everyone to see.
And do you have a big party when it comes out?
We had a party for the first book. We had things going on with the second book. For the third book, A Killer's Alibi, I plan to have a party. I'll tell you about the series briefly. It's called the Philadelphia Legal Series. All the books are set in Philadelphia. The first book is called A Criminal Defense. And it's about a lawyer whose best friend, who's a powerful Philadelphia businessman, is accused of murdering a local television journalist. The second book is very loosely based on the Train 188 crash, an engineered injustice. And in an engineered injustice, the engineer is framed for crashing this big passenger train. And his cousin, who's a lawyer, who becomes the main protagonist, sets out to save his cousin from these charges because in his heart he knows his cousin didn't make a mistake, didn't deliberately or even negligently cause this train crash.
And what was the what is the crash that it was based on? Not just the number, but
yeah, it was – and you probably remember this. This is the crash of the train that went around the curve up in Frankfurt, and it was going too fast in the curve, right, and it derailed. In the book, An Engineered Injustice, the train doesn't roll off of a curve. It crashes into a big piece of track machinery. And the central mystery is, how could this engineer traveling down a straightaway not have seen that giant piece of track equipment and at least tried to stop, applied his brakes, sounded his horn, do something, instead of just going, you know, full force, full speed, no warning, no stopping, into the track machine. And so that's what everybody's trying to figure out, why that happened. And the people who are after the engineer are saying he wasn't paying attention, and the protagonist finds out what really happened, and it's much more nefarious than that.
So it's called the Philadelphia Legal Series?
Yes, the Philadelphia Legal Series.
And that's, how is it, where is that listed that way? Like, is there...
If you go into Amazon and you type in Philadelphia Legal Series, all the books will come up. Or if you type in any of the individual book names, A Criminal Defense, An Engineered Injustice, A Killer's Alibi, that will also bring up the whole series.
As I said the last time, are you the new John Grisham?
I'd like to be the new John Grisham in terms of sales. Not just because... Obviously, you're selling a lot more books and you're making a lot more money, but because I love that people are reading what I'm writing. And if you ask any author, what do you want more than anything? I want to be read. You know, you put your heart and your soul and your mind into these books, and it's an all-consuming thing. And it gives you so much pleasure when somebody says, I'm reading your book, I'm loving it, or I read your book and I loved it. Or even some of the reviews where they don't like the book. I like to read those reviews because I do learn from them. But it's, you know, you put this stuff out there into the world, and it's kind of like you're bearing your soul. Will they like it? Will they not like it? And just to have people read it is, I mean, it's a feeling I can't even describe.